all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven. Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, William, and now, with this war, the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder. He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head and continued. You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire.
Insulate?
Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed, we will say, on a neat mahogany stand. All arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction, the widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign as agreed. Women! Widows! Women in black! Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple-black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago, in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay blanketed with wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do. But they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinised the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue.
Nelbert Lot says Phil Pa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says.
My Bert, says Bill Grandad, the old man, sugar.
Sugar flack it was greens.
Sugar, sugar, sugar.
The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers standing cool, firm and upright in the earth with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way and closes his eyes and opens them and, seeing the brass candlestick again, finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flowerbed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there, letting the words fall over her, swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it. Let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf, he was doubtful whether the thin texture, which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns, would bear his weight. And this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun. Lucky it isn't Friday, he observed. Why? Do you believe in luck? They make you pay sixpence on Friday. What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence? What's it? What do you mean by it? Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean. The couple stood still on the edge of the flowerbed and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something, words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows, so they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth, what precipices aren't concealed in them, or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side. Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, he felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them. And the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Heavens, what were those shapes? Little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him. And there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece, and it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket, real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real, and then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people. Come along, Trissy, it's time we had our tea. Wherever does one have one's tea? She asked, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol, turning her head this way and that way, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda and a crimson-crested bird. But he bore her on. Thus one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flowerbed and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapour, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of colour, but later both substance and colour dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere. How hot it was! So hot that even the thrush chose to hop like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column above the tallest flowers. The glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun. And in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow white, shapes of all these colours, men, women and children, were spotted for a second upon the horizon, and then, seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat motionless and lay huddled upon the ground, but their voices went wavering from them as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices. Yes, voices. Wordless voices, breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise. Breaking the silence. But there was no silence. All the time, the motor omnibuses were turning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel turning ceaselessly one within another, the city murmured, on the top of which the voices cried aloud and the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colours into the air.
It was produced by Justine Willett. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in high-definition sound. And you can also join us on Twitter at BBC Proms. This is Penny Gore, and we're about to rejoin the BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor Osmo Vanska for two more works. Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, and before that, a rarely heard tone poem by Frederick Delius. Now, throughout this prom season, we've been marking the 150th anniversary of the birth of Delius and of his contemporary Claude Debussy. Now, Delius had quite a struggle in embarking on a musical career at all. His father wanted him to go into the family business, but he eventually gave his wholehearted blessing, partly after some energetic persuasion from Edvard Grieg, who'd met the young Delius in Leipzig and become something of a mentor. Delius not only venerated Grieg, he was also enthralled to the literature and landscape of Scandinavia. He was to draw on Danish texts in several works, including his opera Fenimore and Gerda. But it was a collection of 19th century Norwegian folk tales by Peter Christen Asbjørnsen that gave him the inspiration for Eventyr, Once Upon a Time, where the title can also be translated as Tales of Adventure. Delius started work on it during the First World War, when he was living temporarily in England, staying at the home of Sir Henry Wood. And it was finished back in France at Gré-sur-Loing in 1917, with a grateful dedication to Sir Henry. Well, Delius described this piece not as a tone poem, but as a ballad, and it's certainly full of vivid touches. I suppose you could say that it evokes the spirit of the Norwegian folk tales rather than particular characters or stories. Well, Delius's amanuensis Eric Fenby had quite a good description of it, as well as the warm-hearted, superstitious country folk. He said, "We also glimpse the weird interventions in their lives by the frightening creatures of legend, the trolls, giants, demons, and pixies." In fact, we'll hear a couple of interventions from some of those otherworldly beings, although slightly mysterious ones, rather strange climaxes when you'll hear shouts from an offstage male voice chorus pre-recorded for tonight's performance. Not sure who they might be, trolls perhaps? Delius never quite let on. But here to conduct this performance of Eventyr by Delius is Osmo Vanska, rejoining the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The BBC Symphony Orchestra and a couple of brief pre-recorded interpolations from the men of the BBC Symphony Chorus, giving only the second Brahms performance of Aventure by Frederick Delius, Once Upon a Time, conducted by Osmo Vanska. Music redolent of the strange creatures of Scandinavian myth and inspired by a collection of Norwegian folk tales. Well, after those tales, tonight's prom ends with a symphony by Denmark's greatest composer, Carl Nielsen. He started to write his fifth symphony in 1921 in a mood of deep pessimism, not just in reaction to the breakdown of his marriage, but at the way the whole world seemed to be going in the aftermath of World War I. Here's Osmo Vanska.
I think that we are hearing some emotional part of one individual who has been scared or has heard news about war. And I think that there are some really dark moments in the symphony when it's obvious that he builds more and more tension, and then it's like one is screaming finally because there is no way to say any words, and you hope that there is some better time coming soon.
Osmo Vanska. Well, Nielsen said that the work's theme was the division of dark and light, the battle between evil and good. A battle fought out over the course of just two inventively structured movements. The first including an astonishing, almost frenzied outburst from a side drum. A note on the score instructs the percussionist to run amok, as if at all cost to stop the progress of the music. The second movement's hardly free of conflict either, but little by little a sense of regeneration takes hold. Horns and trumpets proclaim faith in life, and at last, in a blaze of new and resolute optimism, the symphony comes to an end. And it's a very different work from the piece that preceded it, Nielsen's fourth symphony, The Inextinguishable, had been written actually during the First World War, and that had been a passionate affirmation of life and renewal in defiance of conflict. But those depressed years after the war had certainly taken their toll on Nielsen. And coming onto the platform now is Osmo Vanska to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Nielsen's Fifth Symphony.
Thank you.
A final burst of almost manic, defiant energy to end Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony. The work that was, he said, the hardest thing he'd ever tried to do. Performed here at the BBC Proms by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Osmo Vanska, who's making his way back on stage here. And those cheers are for him, although he's going around the orchestra now, picking out some of those players who made such a massive contribution. All of them did, of course, but we have those cheers for the principal clarinet, Richard Hosford. Sterling work from Alex Neal playing that extraordinary side drum solo. Bass trombone and tuba, Dan West and Sam Elliott. And all the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra standing now. Osmo Vanska, one of several Finns conducting in the Proms this season, all of them studying with the same teacher. We've heard Jukka-Pekka Saraste, Susanna Malki and Sakari Oromo. And Osmo Vanska has a particular love of the works of Carl Nielsen. He's conducted the second, fourth and sixth symphonies here at the Proms. And, well, just listen to that. That's a real Proms welcome. Osmo Vanska back on stage. The horn standing now, led by Principal Martin Owen. The trombones and trumpets, the whole of the brass section, in fact. And once again, the woodwind. And timpanist John Chimes underpinning the inexorable sense of militaristic might in that piece. That cheer is for him. And he brought that piece to its apparently optimistic conclusion. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back here on Saturday at 7:30 with Oliver Nussen conducting his own third symphony, plus pieces by Alexander Gurr and a new piece by Helen Grime, a BBC commission, as well as Debussy's complete incidental music for the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian. Well, that's all looking ahead to the weekend, but for the rest of this Monday night on Radio 3, time for me to hand you back now to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Penny, thank you very much. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. And if you tuned in towards the end of that prom and you'd like to hear the whole of it again, the Nielsen, or for that matter the Beethoven, which was just as particularly exhilarating at the start of the concert, and the Mozart Clarinet Concerto played by Michael Collins, then you can listen to it all again either on the Radio 3 website for the next 7 days, or you can tune into Radio 3 on Sunday the 2nd of September when it'll form our Proms repeat programme that day in our Sunday concert slot. That's from 2 o'clock that afternoon. Tomorrow afternoon, incidentally, you can hear the prom which was given by the BBC Philharmonic when they celebrated Nordic composers. Stephen Osborne joined the orchestra to play Grieg's piano concerto. There was also music by Per Norgard, the first performance of his seventh symphony in the UK, and two symphonies, no less, by Sibelius, the number 6 and to end the number 3. That's all tomorrow afternoon here on Radio 3 from 2. Well, next tonight at 10, Norman Lebrecht interviews another artist to appear at this year's Proms, the man who has shot to fame since he became the music director of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, Andrus Nelsons, with whom he'll be performing tomorrow night at the BBC Proms. They're going to be performing music by Glinka, a new piece given its UK premiere by Emily Howard, and to end that long and intense march to release the Leningrad Symphony, Shostakovich's 7th Symphony. All live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30 tomorrow night. But tonight, as I say, you can hear the man with the baton in his hand, Andrus Nelsons, talking about his life and his career to date and what drove his love of music, which began, as you will no doubt hear, with Wagner at the tender age of 5. He talks to Norman Lebrecht tonight at 10. Well, to take us there, I thought we could hear some Shostakovich now. Music for smaller forces than full orchestra. This is a very passionate and deeply felt set of preludes by Shostakovich, composed originally for piano. He composed 24 of them, in fact, in 1932 when he was just 26 years old. And I'd say you can really hear the influence here of the many years he'd spent by then producing plenty of film music, particularly in this selection of 7 of the preludes, which were translated transcribed subsequently by Yevgeny Shtakov for viola and piano, and brought brilliantly to life here in this recording in the playing of Lawrence Powers. Simon Crawford Phillips is the pianist.
Thank you.
7 of the preludes from the 24 by Shostakovich, originally for piano, in that sensitive transcription for viola and piano by Yevgeny Strakhov. Lawrence Power played the viola, Simon Crawford Phillips the piano. And that brings the time to nearly 5 to 10. At 10, the conductor who is masterminding tomorrow night's prom, Andras Nelsons, will be in conversation with Norman Lebrecht. Now, as I mentioned, you can hear Grieg's Piano Concerto in our proms programme tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3. Stephen Osborne, the soloist in that recent proms performance with the BBC Philharmonic. That's at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Well, to take us to 10 o'clock tonight, here's some Grieg now, and in the hands of another BBC orchestra, this time the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and conducted by a long-time associate of them, Jerzy Maksymiuk. This is Orza's Death. Grieg's depiction of the death of Peer Gynt's mother, Åsa. Music from the first of his suites from Peer Gynt, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Maksymiuk. And still time to hear their proms appearance from last week, including their highly acclaimed performance of not one, not two, but three symphonies by Vaughan Williams, conducted to a packed house by Andrew Manzi. It's all there for a couple more days on the BBC Radio 3 website.
Original British drama on BBC Two. A tale of love and repression in Edwardian England.
I know what it is that makes a man want to go away with a woman he likes, but that desire must be resisted.
Adapted for television by Tom Stoppard and starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Rebecca Hall.
You're such a paragon of honourable behaviour, Christopher. You're the cruelest man I know.
Bound by convention to duty and unhappiness.
I stand for monogamy. Monogamy and chastity.
Parade's End begins this Friday night at 9 on BBC Two.
This is BBC Radio 3. A very good evening to you. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and in high definition online. 10 o'clock is the time now. Time for this week's Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Andris Nelsons is the go-to conductor of the new generation. He's a regular with the Vienna Philharmonic, first call for vacant US orchestras, a fixture at Bayreuth and Luzern, and high in the list to succeed Antonio Pappano at Covent Garden, James Levine at the Met. He's mentioned everywhere. He's been music director of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra since 2008, and before that, of Latvian National Opera. Remarkably, he's just 33 years old. Andris Nelsons is a very modern type of maestro. He was the first to take paternity leave in the middle of a busy concert season when his wife, Christina Opolis, gave birth last December. And when the baby developed complications, he broke off a prestigious orchestral tour to spend several months at her bedside. Born in Riga to a pair of professional musicians, he played trumpet and sang bass baritone before taking up the baton. He's the only private pupil of the shy and deeply contemplative Maris Janssens. His performances are marked by fluidity, passion, and a profound sense of tradition, most notably when he gave the 50th anniversary concert earlier this year of the Britain War Requiem in Coventry Cathedral. In the thick of a crowded summer, we struggled to meet up, finally getting together in Bayreuth between performances of Lohengrin. Andris Nelsons, looking out over the Wagner Hill, you must be the youngest man ever to conduct a complete ring in Riga. How old were you?
I was in the middle of 20s, I think mid-20s. So, but I think in the history there have been conductors conducting...
So young?
I'm not the youngest, I don't think I...
Right.
I mean, if you can call it conducting when you were 20, you know. That's...
I mean, what is it at that sort of age? Is it that you don't know fear, or that you don't look down?
You know, when I was 18 years old, I got married first time. No, it's second time, which is my last time, I'm sure. But, and I thought, I know everything. I'm old enough to make decisions in my life, to be ready for family, and that I really am very confident. And in a way, that's also for young musicians. I think it's a certain sense of this feeling that you think, I am ready to express my feelings. It's not that I was ready and thought that I know many things, but I thought I know what I would like to express through music, and I think it is enough. And now I realize it's absolutely not enough. Now when I look back, I would never conduct pieces like what I did in my 20s, and I think I'm now a young conductor, and I think, you know, I don't want to sound, you know, it's a bit tough what I would say, but I don't think that conductor in 20s, you can really call that you have a right to for interpretation. I mean, you have a right for interpretation, but it is like there is a certain age. In some countries, it's 18 years, in some countries, it's 21. When you call yourself grown up, and when you can start drink alcohol,
yeah,
officially. So, and I think in the conductor, it's certainly not in 20s. I would say. Mm. And yesterday even listened to YouTube some interviews with Karajan and with all the other conductors, where he was talking to Ozawa, asking him, how old are you? He told him, 46. So he said, oh, you are so many things to learn still. And so I thought, actually, it means development of conductors all your life. So therefore, I think there is a fearless feeling when you are in your 20s. And this helps. I think for that age, it's important, because then you have the feeling that you can do this piece, you can do Beethoven 9, you can do, you know, some Mahler symphonies, which actually is almost too early for calling you as an interpreter in that age. But I think if you do it in the right places, you need to start sometime, I think, and then to develop on the repertoire. And I don't think you can do a very deep Mahler's Second Symphony when you do it first time when you're 65, if you haven't done it before. I mean, you can do it very deep, but you lack some even technical and professional skills which you need to experience through the age. So I think it's actually not bad if you start early. It's just you shouldn't call yourself a maestro. I would say generally getting older, if I may say, realizing that I don't know how people can at any age say, I know the right way of doing certain things. So I think with age, you get more and more divided in your thoughts about what is right and what is wrong. And actually, it doesn't get better, but it gets worse.
So now do you say to yourself, there are certain pieces I'm not going to do again until, or I'm not going to do at all until I'm at such an age, because I'm not ready for them?
Well, I think that the one thing is, I certainly would know there are certain orchestras which I wouldn't want to go to do certain pieces too early. Mm-hmm. Because, firstly, there are such a great maestros who have done it in the past in the age which is more suitable, maybe. Or also, you need to go through a certain tradition experience. Because there's some strong traditions how to play certain pieces, and the good traditions you have to know. And if you go in front of the, you know, Berlin Philharmonic or Vienna Philharmonic or, you know, Concertgebouw, and you do Mahler symphony which you have never done before, or you know, I think this is a not so clever move. But from the other hand, when you look to the history, you know, that each of these great conductors in the past, they have started early. So. But I think the thing is, they didn't start with the top orchestras immediately. So they went through the certain period of learning and of going through the repertoire and the experience.
In small towns,
yeah. And I think that's very, it's very tempting nowadays that you can sometimes such an offer to do things which you always wanted to do, but you have to judge. You have to have a very strong judgment of yourself, and that's. That's, I think, a difficulty.
So you were married and conducting opera before you were old enough to vote. Where did this confidence come from? This feeling in your late teens, I'm ready, I can do anything. Was that your parents? Was that society?
Yeah, I think it's a certain, I think, influence of the times where we're living. I think it was the Soviet Union still until I was 12. From one hand, you were kind of, you couldn't express what you really were feeling in these years. So you have to keep many things inside you. So you were not allowed to go almost into the church. So you could be very secretly to go to church, or you couldn't talk about the history openly. You couldn't discuss it even with your parents because it was forbidden. If somebody would find it out, it would be dangerous. And I think all of this energy which was hiding inside, came out in these years of, you know, gaining independence of the country, which was...
End of communism. Independent Latvia.
Independent Latvia, yes. And then influence of Western world opening the doors for such a huge amplitude.
Do you remember the night that communism ended, that Latvia became independent?
I remember, yes. I was not scared then. Now I would be... I don't know, I would probably go with my family to even to Africa or somewhere just to hide. But then I was very brave, you know, there was tanks in the city, and my stepfather, he went, you know, there were people just guarding near the television house, near the radio house, just to protect from the tanks, you know, as with the life, as it happened in these years. But I was not afraid. It was a very patriotic and very optimistic time in a certain sense. And I think all this energy came out, and this was a time when I started to play trumpet, when I started to sing, and I was encouraged to practice a lot in order to succeed something in life. And that was this extreme energy, an extreme patriotic feeling. And I was playing trumpet 6 hours a day, you know, at school from 8 to 2, and then from 2 to 7 o'clock every day, practicing. And I thought I would need to become a good trumpet player, or I could go out to other countries and I could express myself. And this was, I think, a very big push from this historical political situation which is around, I think, as well.
It's quite an unusual response, Andres, because, you know, if you're 12 or 14 and suddenly freedom comes, then you want to grab freedom with everything. What you're describing is you are grabbing discipline, you're grabbing hard work, you're playing the trumpet 6 hours a day, you're investing in your future rather than seizing the moment.
That's right, yes. I don't know why it happened. I think this is, it, in a way, a certain illusion about great life. Not life, great life in the sense of the comfort and money, but in a artistically and humanly fulfilled life. And I always thought, maybe because of my parents and education, that you need to deserve things. You need to
earn them.
Work hard to earn them. Mm-hmm. And now, with this independence coming, you saw the light at the end of the tunnel. So you thought, it is possible. So because in the Soviet time, you thought, well, I can do anything, but nobody, I would even not be able to go to another country because it's just, you know, it's just closed. And But now you thought, you know, the whole world is open, and if you earn something, you can really experience a different kind of life. And I don't know, it gave you a lot of discipline. I must say, that's probably why there's a lot of in my generation, and maybe a little older, musicians coming from this part of the world. I think this is very much for this reason. And also, of course, because of the education and the musical education and the, you know, tradition of very good singing tradition and so on. But it's also a political situation.
Is this something that came from inside, or that someone said to you that if you work hard enough, you will deserve freedom?
No, I think this. I was educated
in that way.
In that way. So,
tell me about your parents. Your father was principal cello in the National Orchestra.
Yeah, my father was principal cello in the National Symphony Orchestra, although my stepfather, he was the one who grew me up,
yeah.
And he introduced me to music. And of course, my mother, she's a professor in music academy, and so she was a founder of first early music group in Latvia. It was the first ensemble who was singing Renaissance and Baroque music and English madrigals in Italian. And
that's really radical under communism.
It is very radical, yes.
And was she taking a risk?
In a certain, yes, I
yes.
think she was taking a certain risk, of course, because everybody always thought, you know, in that time, that if you do something what Western Europe does, it is not good and it's against the party.
She was a rebel.
Yeah.
And she sang English madrigals to you.
Yeah.
What did she sing?
Well, I remember, you know, the Silver Swan, mostly English madrigals. Lasciatemi morire with Monteverdi, then Gesualdo and all these great composers, William Byrd and Tully's Mass. And it was my first musical experience. And of course, from the other hand, my stepfather, he introduced me to Wagner. I was 5 years old when he took me to the first opera. It was Tannhäuser in Riga. But even then, before I went to the opera, he put me LPs, and we were listening to Tannhäuser, and he was analyzing and told what is this about, and what is the story, and what is the feeling. And I knew the music before I was actually going to listen to the opera, so...
You were 5 years old.
I was 5 years old.
And you knew all the themes of Tannhäuser,
yes,
before you...
He told this is the leitmotiv of this and that, and so this is the influence, of course, certainly of my parents as well, as why I'm a musician, really, and that's... I still remember this time listening to Tannhäuser. We just switched off the lights so we to have the feeling of being in the audience, in the room, in the house. And then we listened to the music, and then I just was sitting, and I still remember. It was so great feeling. And I still have this... And you probably, I think it's like when you smell the perfume. It always associates with certain person or certain time or certain place. When you... You know, smell all this perfume. I remember this place, and I have this association with Wagner, and it's such a warm and such a mystic feeling, which I associate. I still remember this feeling exactly what I was when I was five, when I conduct Wagner now. So I think this association, which goes through your life, with this experience, it comes from really from my parents and from my childhood.
And when you go to see the performance for the first time and you're 5 years old and you're dressed up in your best clothes and you're going with your parents to the opera house, what was your first impression of the opera house and of the performance of the stage?
Two things I remember very clearly. One was this nervousness which started when the lights went down.
Mm-hmm.
And this expectation of something special. And it's such a nervousness. My heart was beating very fast. And then the other feeling is that that's where my conducting dream came from. Because when the conductor came on the podium, I was very nervous about him. I thought, oh my God, this guy, he is doing something with his hands and everybody is playing. And if he does something wrong, it can stop and he can destroy everything. And I thought, it's such a responsibility. And that's why I thought, I would love to be involved in this, with music in this way. So actually you can build with your hands and be responsible of such a thing. And then another thing I remember, I was crying after the opera. I was really crying when Tannhäuser died. And when there came this, the ladies' choir at the end, and Gwent is so touching, and I was crying.
It's quite an unusual combination of emotions that you're describing. You're feeling a strong identity with the conductor and a terrible anxiety that he's going to make a mistake and bring everything crashing down and it will be the end of the world. And that you would like to be him, you would like to take over. So in a sense, you're wishing for his success and you're wishing for his death.
Well,
is that what you feel now when you stand in the podium?
You know, I think there is a certain sense, it's very difficult to describe, but there's a certain sense of masochism involved, you know. It's not only in joy, which is of course the great joy to conduct and to feel this joy of conducting, but this is also this joy of being nervous, you know, of having this fear or anxiety, which gives you this feeling that actually something can go wrong, I mean, very easily.
The fear that you're describing is actually part of the pleasure.
I think it's part of the pleasure, first part of the satisfaction of conducting, because that you hear your heart beating and sweating because of the anxiety and it's like expectation of something. When you the music, they're playing Lohengrin, for example, in second act, there is one place after duet of Elsa and Ortrud where the orchestra plays a very beautiful solo line, and I'm waiting for this moment for the first act, and I'm my heart is starting to beat when it comes, and I feel, you know, this kind of feeling of masochism, and you think it also can go wrong. It's a wrong feeling to be a conductor, maybe in this way to think like that, but I don't have this confidence. Of some people say I have rehearsed, I'm very confident, everything will be fine, and I will do a good concert. And you know, I'm a boss, or I never have this kind of feeling when I'm conducting. Never have the feeling of being a boss of a situation, because it's at the end, you are only conducting, you are only in front of these people. Just there's a lot of faith involved, that you trust them, that actually they will play and they will sing or they will do everything in the right way. And I actually, there's a lot of anxiety about how it will going to happen. You never know how the concert or performance will go. There's always this anxiety, and I think this would give you the pleasure as well. I mean, of course, maybe it's a confession, which I say it doesn't sound very very typical conductor like. You need to be confident. Of course, there's a confidence, but you project
a confidence to the musicians, to the singers. They have to believe you're going to lead them to the right place.
Yeah. No, I think this is the, because there's so much psychology, of course, involved, and that's. But it's never the feeling that, for example, of confidence or guarantee something. It's just a, you can guarantee that you do everything possible. But I think it's a more feeling of creating at the moment. So not that you have rehearsed it before and now you know what you're going to get, but you have rehearsed. But actually now you are creating during the concert and you don't know how it's going to be. So it's, from that sense, I think, for me, very close, you know, like Kleiber, for example, somebody like, of course, absolutely unconfident people who, genius.
Yes.
But I think probably it's also this kind of masochistic feeling, what you have towards yourself. It's a self-criticism, but which gives a pleasure and actually which pushes you to make a better result. So there is no routine involved. And I don't know, it's a strange combination, I personally think. I mean, it's a big confession, but it's strangely, when I conduct, then I don't have this doubt. During the conducting, I don't know where the power comes, where the confidence comes from, but that's why I decided to conduct, because during conducting, I see that I overcome my fear of being, you know, shy or being judged. It disappears when I'm on the podium. Before, you think, how I will go, what I will do there. But then you go there, you just, something happens. And that's why, that was the first time I experienced it. Conducting when I was 17, I conducted the high school orchestra in rehearsal. And I felt so great. The best place in the world was that moment for me. I felt myself, that I can be so open, and I'm not shy anymore. I always, you know, was, and that's why I decided to become conductor, because I thought that's the best place for me. When I was playing trumpet, I felt always nervous and never satisfied.
And then while you were playing trumpet, you were also singing and taking singing lessons.
Yeah.
And you came to England, you did masterclasses with Evelyn Tubb, Emma Kirkby.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of being a professional singer, a bass baritone?
Yes, I was thinking, confidently. Of course, I was singing a lot of Baroque and Renaissance music at first. And I went to the master classes here, and it was in Dartington master course, I remember. It was a really wonderful time. And then I thought I was doing more Bach and some classical repertoire, some Rossini. And then I really wanted to become a bass baritone. But I thought if I was a tenor, I probably would have been a singer. Because I thought, you know, when, in that age, when I was 18, 17, I thought, you know, I wouldn't like to be Basilio or Bartolo. I want to be Almaviva, or I want to be Alfredo or Rodolfo. You know, if I can't be, then I. Now I think actually singing Scarpia, for example, I think it's more interesting than Cavaradossi or. But I think I was keeping trumpet, singing, and started to study conducting. And at one moment I did the whole three together. And I thought I would continue it. Then I realized, of course, you can't. It's not enough time.
You can only do one.
You can only do one, you know. And then it came to conducting. And actually, I'm very happy. And I realized how lucky I was that I could play in the orchestra myself and be involved in singing to try to understand the breathing of the body, you know, and how much it helps for music now, for opera or symphony. I value it so much now because it's. It helps me so much to
talk to the singers and to help
and
them.
And to kind of realize that everything is, again, the rhythm, the feeling of rhythm and being precise, it's a very relative term, you know, to me. I think it's, for me, I think it's so much to do with heartbeat. And one moment it's 60, and in one moment 62 beats, a second and then 68. And the composers never... Except some people like Mahler, for example, who was a conductor himself. I think that's why he did in each bar almost something, Nicht Eilen, Nicht Schleppen, because he knew that you would like to, and he leads you with his heartbeat. But it doesn't mean that the symphony of Brahms Brahms was meaning it exactly with no sense of breathing. I might be wrong again, but it helped to understand that everything is more relative than that. You can't put everything on the paper, which is actually inside the music.
So interpretation begins with your own bodily sensations.
I think so. It's very strongly that if you feel uncomfortable, you lack the air when you listen to music, or...
You're holding your stomach as you say this. You're talking as a singer.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Then I think... Obviously, it's a sign that something is wrong to me. I don't know. The other thing is, of course, sometimes music especially wants to make you sick, you know, in some moments when you take tempo a little slower than the heart does.
Yep.
And then you feel that you will just collapse because it makes you sick. And and you can consciously make this sense for audience. But I think it all comes from the... body pulsation and the biological watch or something, I don't know.
The trumpet, which is also about breathing, gave you your first break. Maris Janssens came to Riga with the Oslo Philharmonic, was performing Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, and his first trumpet fell sick. And you were how old?
I think I was about 23. Yes, I was about 22, 23.
Right. And you just came out from the wings and...
Yes, I was in the audience, and of course I I was sitting in the audience already, and then I told, well, the manager came to me and he heard I played trumpet. Can I do the Symphony Fantastique in the next half because I have four trumpets? So I ran to get my trumpet and did the symphony with Maurice, and it was another great push for me to realize that I really want to become a conductor somehow. Seeing him, of course, and I was already then studying conducting, and
And you're getting a lot of special eye contact with him in the performance because you haven't rehearsed.
Yes, of course, special eye contact. And I realized that, I mean, his way, of course, it's so much encouraging. Of course, it's clear technically, but it's so much inspiring that I thought that's how the conductor should be. And that's when I realized that I want to be, to lead the orchestra the same direction as he has showed me.
And then you just went up to him afterwards and said, please, can I study with you?
He asked for me to come to say thanks, and well, and they asked me, how much do you want to be paid? And I told, I don't want to be paid, but can I go to see you in Oslo, you know? And I went to Oslo to see him, and then that's how we started. I showed my videos. I've been conducting in the youth orchestra, and that's how we started. He told if he would have an assistant position, he would take me as assistant, that he didn't have, because I was so lucky that day. I remember I was calling home. You know, Maurice just told that he, you know, I was remember this. And of course, then I started to follow him, and then I was 22, I remember, yeah, 22 then. And it all started at Oslo. And it's interesting that I conducted Oslo Philharmonic, also Symphony Fantastique, many years later. And it was a great, interesting memory because of seeing the same musicians I was playing with and to do the same symphony. And the same trumpet player colleagues which were playing in the orchestra.
He has fantastic technical knowledge,
yeah,
of the orchestra. Did he also give you a philosophy of conducting?
I think so. I think that's actually probably the most important thing, I would say. It's a philosophy and the meaning of conducting, which is, I think, in my opinion, that the reason why I really conduct it is, this is this encouragement, to encourage, to give the atmosphere and to open your fantasy to music and to be as a soul of the piece, you know, in a certain sense as a soul. You almost have a reincarnation that the moment you conduct the Brahms or Mahler or somebody comes, the spirit comes into you or in a certain sense, and then you just reincarnate, and then at that moment
you become the composer,
and
you become the piece.
Become the piece, and I think that's the soul of the piece, and that's the meaning of conductor. And also came from Maurice, because his way of inspiring musicians with his face, with his hands, with his energy, it's just so, so great. I think in a way I think he continues this kind of Kleiber direction of fantasy world of music.
But it's also...
combines, of course, his own influence of Karajan Mravinsky and his own great talents. So it's... But this kind of psychological involvement as a conductor, so how to work with musicians, it's a lot of psychological invitation to them, so they feel that they want to do it for you. It's not that you force, because they need to know why they need to do this or this tempo, because you explain the character or the atmosphere, and also that you have to be always very prepared, that we always... And rehearsals, that's an extremely important thing, because rehearsal process is the most important, I think, for conductor during the making chemistry with the orchestra and creating the family together. If it doesn't happen in rehearsal, it's very difficult, I think, to create in the concert, because you don't have a trust from each other and there is a certain reservation, and you can never flow into the same flow, you know. I think if you get this feeling in the rehearsals, then the concerts can be just, you know, explosion, and that's why it's important, he always told. And his way of rehearsing is really very extraordinary, so very prepared and always. So I think there's so many things I learned from him, you know, and in the meantime, of course, there are things if you spend a lot of time with somebody, you, of course, subconsciously take something, and you can't, you know, you can't avoid that. But you can never copy. It doesn't work. It's just, you know.
The same year that you stand in as trumpet in the Oslo Philharmonic, they ask you to become principal conductor of the National Opera. in Latvia. What was your response? You're 23 years old.
I was 23 years old, yes. And it's really strange because that was the orchestra I was playing myself. I was playing the opera orchestra in Riga myself since 17. And I did some performances when I was 21, you know, some Traviata, some Malo Balo Maschera, and I was playing in the orchestra and conducted, you know, once in 3 months a performance and studied parallelly. I couldn't say no somehow because I always wanted to conduct, and I was studying, and of course I took the chance, and I always thought that it's a really dangerous if you come from the same orchestra. It's really almost impossible if you play in the same orchestra as you then conduct. It's very difficult for you to get the, not the authority, but just to